Lindsay Addario was a fledgling photographer when the September 11 attacks changed the world. One of the few photojournalists with experience in Taliban-ruled Afghanistan, she jumped at the opportunity to return and cover the American invasion, making a decision she would often find herself making, to not stay home leading a quiet or predictable life, but to instead set out across the world risking her own life, not only to make a name for herself, but also to make a difference. Her memoir is It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Lindsay Addario to the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lindsay is an American photojournalist whose work appears regularly in the New York Times, National Geographic, and Time magazine. And again, the title of the new book is It's What I Do. At what point did you realize you wanted to tell readers and tell us as a whole what you do?
Well, it was a gradual process. I think I had been photographing as a hobby for a long time, and I moved to Argentina after university, and I started photographing for a newspaper there. And I realized that photojournalism was this great marriage between photography and journalism and telling stories and a way to show people what's happening around the world. And that's when I realized I wanted to be a photojournalist. It wasn't until I moved to India in 2000, where I started traveling to Afghanistan under the Taliban, where I realized some of that work might be in conflict zones.
They say that you can't judge a book by its cover. In this case, I think you can judge a book by its cover. It's a beautiful cover because the book is beautiful, and it's beautifully crafted because it's filled with your photography, it's filled with photography, which really makes the point, doesn't it, that these photos and what you are doing are so much a part of your life, or so much a part of this memoir.
Well, it's interesting because I'm a photographer naturally, and I've never done a photo book. I've never done a book exclusively of my images. I've done collections with other photographers, but I certainly haven't sat down and sort of decided what sort of retrospective or created a body of work that is exclusively for a coffee table book. And so when I decided to write a book, I wanted to include photographs because for me it was such a natural thing to do. Obviously, it was my primary means of expression for the last two decades, and so I wanted to include the photographs in the memoir.
Is that difficult to decide which is going to be a part and what story you're going to tell and what photo is going to accompany that particular story?
Yes, because I feel like in looking at this book, I don't feel like it is my greatest collection of photographs.
Right.
I definitely feel like I selected those photos because they helped illustrate the stories I was telling. When I started writing the book, I started by sort of writing vignettes. I sat and I thought about what were the most poignant, powerful scenes that I had witnessed over the years, and I started writing those scenes. And then I went back and I looked for the photos to illustrate those. And it wasn't necessarily like those were my best, most poetic photos or were my most powerful photos. Ironically, the words really took precedent in this book.
As you point out, I mean, you're going to these parts of the world that are war-torn, that are devastated. You are among the first in your field to witness the devastation in Darfur. You go to the Congo and you expose this culture of violence against women. How do you choose, and what was often the impetus to go to these particular places to tell the story that you wanted to tell through the photography?
Yeah, it's a difficult question because each story, I've sort of entered each story very differently. I mean, generally, what happens is I'm constantly reading the news or watching the news or reading about certain issues. And I've always been attracted to women's issues and humanitarian issues and human rights abuses. And so I'm constantly reading and looking at those stories. And sometimes as I'm reading, I realize that I'm sort of overcome by this feeling that I should go there and I need to tell the story and I need to help these people get their message out or try to do justice to this situation. And so that is one way that I sort of become aware of a story and I decide, okay, I'm going to go there. And then that sort of is followed by a very lengthy process of research and reaching out to humanitarian workers, NGOs, people working in those places and saying, you know, what is it like on the ground? Can I get there? Can I access this situation? And setting up the infrastructure, basically, for me to go in and tell a story. Another way of me sort of deciding what to cover is, for example, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, I am an American, and obviously what happened on September 11th, it hit home for all of us, and I wanted to be there. I wanted to be in Afghanistan. I wanted to be in Iraq, and I wanted to document what war was like and what it was like for our troops. You know, there were thousands of American soldiers that went in and out of combat, and I wanted to be there and provide a historical document and bear witness to what was happening, because for me, obviously, it was one of the most historical moments of our time.
One of the things that I find just extraordinary about this memoir is how you chronicle just how sad and witnessing this the sadness and this injustice, and how that has an effect on you, how it has to have an effect on you.
Yeah, I mean, it's been it's interesting because for many years I sort of just weaved sort of in and out of these places without stopping for one second. I would go from Darfur to Iraq to Saudi Arabia to Congo to you know, from one place to another, and I never stop to process things. I speak about things very openly. I communicate very openly, and for me that was my means of psychologically processing them, but I had never really sat down with my thoughts. And so that this memoir for me was so therapeutic, and such it was really a privilege to take the time, sit down, and just literally download years and years of memories. And I had kept journals for part of it. I went back and interviewed my colleagues. I asked questions of my family. I interviewed my own relatives. So there was a really long process of trying to get these memories in order.
You tell the story about your imprisonment during the Libyan Civil War. You were in prison for how long?
Well, it wasn't prison. We were held captive for about a week. We were taken on the 15th of March and released on the 21st. And we spent the first 2 days we were sort of shuttled around the front line and tied up and sometimes blindfolded, beaten up repeatedly, threatened with execution. And eventually they transferred us to a prison in Sirte. And that was for about, I think, 24 hours, and we were in one prison cell, the four of us together. And then we were transferred, we were flown in a military aircraft to Tripoli, and then we were put in a sort of VIP prison, which was almost like an apartment with bars on the windows, and we couldn't see outside, and they said, if you attempt to open the window or the door, we'll kill you. And that was for the 3 days that we were in Tripoli.
You have to start questioning things, right? Of questioning what it is, maybe not at that point, but about what it is that you're doing that is putting you in that danger, and what you're giving up to take these photographs.
Well, I mean, that questioning is a process that I have done throughout my career. I mean, obviously, if I am constantly risking my life, I'm constantly asking myself those questions. Why am I doing this? What am I putting my family through? Will I get killed? Will I make it home? You know, so those questions repeatedly come up throughout my career. And when I was taken in March of 2011, I had already been abducted in Garma, which is a village outside of Fallujah, in 2004. That was just for one day. The vision of watching the road fill up with insurgents with heavily armed and knowing that I was the captive, you know, knowing that I was the target is something that is psychologically very traumatizing, because I knew that, you know, okay, my life might end right now. So what happened in Libya, I was sort of familiar with that sheer terror and panic. And I do ask myself those questions. And during our captivity, there was a moment when we were in prison in Sirte where we were able to speak to each other freely. And we asked each other those questions. Will you go back to war? Will you keep doing this? And me and Anthony and Tyler were not very convinced that we would stop doing this, because I think for most people who do this for a living, it is not just a job. It is not just a way to earn money and you wake up and it's 9 to 5. I mean, it is your life and you believe in these things. And so you don't, it's not so easy to just stop doing it. And I think that for me personally, I feel there are ways I can sort of redraw the boundaries and sometimes do less dangerous assignments and do other stories. Not every story has to be full-on war. You know, I believe that there are so many peripheral stories and stories that happen as a result of war.
The other fascinating aspect is that you, through your work, are often exposing this, as I mentioned, this culture of violence against women. You are showing oppression towards women, and yet you are also dealing with your own discrimination within the profession that you have chosen, because this is very much a boys' club.
Yeah, it is a boys' club. I think now, you know, I've been around a long time, longer than I can believe, and now I've sort of proven myself, so I don't get that discrimination as much. But certainly when I started out, I felt like I had to prove myself, and people were always sort of looking at me and saying, oh, you know. And yes, my gender has been the subject of, will we get the same access if you're along? And so I think certainly it's been an issue, but I also think that these situations, you know, especially on the front line or in a combat zone, it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. You know, basically the bottom line is you've got to move quickly, think on your feet, and be able to navigate danger and also do the work. So, you know, it's something that is a skill. It's something that with more experience you become better and you start to understand how to read the rhythms of war.
There are so many extraordinary images in the book, but there is one, and it is of a U.S. Air Force soldier standing, I assume, on a bus while another soldier who has been wounded is lying with just a tangle of wires and machinery and ventilators and so forth. It's a very moving, incredible image, and I just bring it up because it seems to me that a situation like that would never escape you.
No, I mean, I remember taking that photo, and I remember it took my breath away. I mean, I had been covering war at that point for about 3 years, and I had never seen anything like that. And I think generally, journalists don't have easy access to those scenes. And I was on assignment for Life magazine, and I was working with a correspondent, Johnny Dwyer. And his father and grandfather were both in the military in some capacity. They were medics or doctors. And so we were given this access to come and document the wounded coming out of Fallujah. And we went to Balad Air Force Base, and I remember just seeing these sorts of scenes and photographing them and thinking, I can't believe we've never seen this before. And the military didn't, they were wide open with the access. Once we got the clearance from high up, the only stipulation they made for us was that we had to get permission from everyone I photographed. And if they were unconscious, then we would get permission from them when they woke up. This image was just, to me, just shocking. And I remember after I finished the assignment, I flew back through Germany, through Landstuhl and back to the U.S. and sent the photos to Life magazine, and they didn't publish them for months. I filed them in November, and in February I got an email from my photo editor saying, you know, we will never publish these pictures, and sort of off the record, because they're just too strong for the American public. And to me, it was just heartbreaking, because I thought, you know, we're at war. We are sending these kids to war. We need to publish this stuff. I mean, in Vietnam, there was not that kind of a sanitizing war.
What do you think that we as a public gain from seeing photos like this, and not months later, but immediate?
Because, I mean, if you look at Vietnam, for example, everything was published. I mean, there was no censorship, and it was brutal, and it was, you know, very gory. And the American public rose up against Vietnam. And I think, you know, we rarely see images of our wounded soldiers and soldiers killed in action. And there are all sorts of rules and paperwork, and there are rules of engagement, there are rules of, you know, journalism. We need to sign everything before we publish this. We'll get permission from this. And so what ultimately ends up happening is we don't we see a very sanitized version of the war. And so I think when a reader sees that picture of a young man who is looks like he's holding on by a thread because he has cables, and that's how he was being flown to Germany, to me, that's what happens in war. You know, these are our young men, they're American, and they're going to war, and this is what's happening. And if you don't show that, then no one sees what happens in war.
And also the reverence and the suffering of the soldier standing next to him.
Exactly, because you see the pain in his face,
right?
You know, and I've been in those situations, and everyone is thinking, you know, this could be me, this could be, you know, and this young man has a family, and he's got parents who don't know that he's been injured. And so I think it's very important to put these images out there, to let the American public see, look, we've gone into Iraq, and this is how we're coming out.
When it comes to many of the photos in the book, and I'm certainly not suggesting that all human life is not important. It certainly is.
Sure.
But my God, it's hard to look at the pictures in this book and not be taken aback by how young everyone looks, by the youth that is so often lost in these conflicts.
Do you mean the soldiers? Do you mean
I mean the soldiers and the civilians and in the villages, and even for those who are not in a violent situation but are still impacted by the conflict and the war?
Sure. I mean, and that is a very important point that I try to make with my images, is that, you know, it's rarely the combatants that suffer. I mean, certainly they do, but also civilians take a massive toll in war. And so I think it's very important to show that, and to show that, you know, who are the people who are paying the price? And it's often women, it's often children, it's often people who are helpless, it's often people who can't flee, who don't have the means to get out of the country. I mean, we're looking at Syria right now. I mean, there are millions of Syrian refugees living in the countries bordering Syria and in other countries, and still people are trying to get out, and countries are closing their borders to them.
You have covered, and I mentioned this, but you have covered conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, Lebanon, Darfur, and the Congo. You've received many awards for this, the MacArthur Genius Grant, the Pulitzer Prize for international reporting. Is there a pride that comes in showing and sharing these images when they do eventually, when they get out and we see them? Is there a pride that comes with that?
Well, there's a pride in that I feel like I'm putting them out there and I'm doing my job, in the sense that I'm being a messenger and I'm hoping that people are responding in the visceral way that I myself respond when I witness those scenes. So there's where the pride is for me, because I think that my goal is to educate people, to get them to respond, to get them to care, to get them to pay attention and to things that maybe they wouldn't normally pay attention to. And so certainly if there's a picture, if I have a picture on the front page of the New York Times, I'm proud, because I think, look, at least a million people are going to see that photo. And I'm proud. And I think that I'm still old-fashioned. I still love the front page. I still think it's important, even though we live in primarily a digital era.
There is such beauty and such humanity to the work that you do, and it is such a pleasure, even though that the subjects are so often hard to take, in reading your story and to seeing the work that accompanies it. I thank you so much for spending time with us, and the book is just gorgeous.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. Lindsay Addario, again, thank you very much. Be safe.
Thank you. Take care.
It's What I Do is published by Penguin Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.